Please help me to welcome our speaker tonight. The speaker is Scott F. from the 12 Keys Group in Bristol, PA.
Hello, my name is Scott Fleming. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I just want to thank Jeff and the group for having me out here. It's an honor to come to speak at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I want to welcome the new people, and I want to say that you're in for an unbelievable journey. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It has transformed my life. I was talking to Ray, a few minutes ago, and he was saying that how, an hour is a long time to go, and I was saying an hour is not enough. Because, well, I'll probably come up short tonight, but I feel my sobriety date is February 13, 2002, so I haven't had a drink in almost come up on 8 years. But I haven't wanted to drink or thought about drinking in probably just over 7.5 years. And in those 7.5 years, I feel like I've lived lifetimes in AA. Lifetimes. So it's hard to talk for only an hour about that, because it has given me so much to offer. I want to start, by telling you that I come from an amazing family. My mom was a kindergarten teacher. My dad was a Vietnam vet who worked hard, and it came from the ghetto of Philadelphia, and they wanted to give their children a better life than they had. And that's what they did. They worked hard. They saved. They bought a house in the suburbs. I have a brother who's a year and a half younger than me who suffered a lot of abuse from my alcoholism before I even picked up the drink. I have a sister that's 10 years younger. And we lived in a good neighborhood, and they gave me a great education. And they got us involved in activities, and they gave us unconditional love and care and support. And I grew up always kind of feeling like if I had to describe it in one word, it would be fear. I don't know if I knew that, to put that word on it at the time, but I just always felt like as I got older and I got in situations where I had to be around you, I would feel threatened. And I would have to kind of overcompensate, and make you think about me something that I wasn't. I'd make up stories, I'd exaggerate, I'd lie. I would have to cut you down if I thought you were smarter than me and things like that. My brother, unfortunately, was there, and I did a lot of that to him. And I grew up in this family, and as I got older, it got harder and harder to be around people and fit in. And I would compensate in many ways. But around the age of 14, alcohol found me, and I had a magical experience with it. It transformed my life. The moment it hit my lips and went into my body, and I started to get that watering of the eyes, and everything changed for me that night. And I was able to do and be and say all the things I wanted to do, be and say. I was able to hang out with the girls, talk with them, and I was able to hang out with the guys and feel like I fit in. And that night, alcohol became the most important thing in my life. But I didn't drink every day from that moment on. I was 14 years old. I didn't have access to it every day. But I can tell you this, that I thought about it every day. And every moment I wasn't drinking, I was just thinking, when can I get that again? When can I have that experience again? And I would go through my, high school years. I couldn't wait to get to the weekend to have the older guys get us the beer or the keg and just to be around at ease and comfort. And then it wasn't enough to just wait for the weekends. I'd have to drink during the week. And this is how my high school career began, started to go. I wasn't a good student in high school. I was not a good student, which made it hard at home because my mom was a teacher. But my parents got me involved with sports, just about every sport you can think of. And I played four sports in high school, and tennis is a sport that I excelled in the most. And my senior year, I had really no plans of going to school. I was going to go to maybe Bucks County Community College to appease my mom. But I knew I wasn't cut out for school, but I got an offer for a scholarship to play in North Carolina tennis. And I took it. But before before I went there, I graduated high school, and I just graduated by the skin of my eye. I almost had to go to summer school, and I had like a D minus average, and in the summer, before I go away to college, I start, you know, everybody graduates, I'm drinking, and I can't stop drinking. I just drink every day, you know, and it's one big blur, and I get arrested, and I get about 5 charges against me. I'm 18 years old, I'm about to go away to the school and have a great experience. I have no idea how I even was going to do that, but it just fell in my lap. And now I'm 18 years old, and my parents, my mom especially, had wanted me to get help with alcohol for like the last year since I was 17, but there's no way you're taking away the one thing that makes me feel comfortable in my own skin. Alcohol has such value to me at that point in my life, and there's no way you're taking that away from me. It allows me to fit in with you. It allows me to feel comfortable in my own skin. So I wasn't trying to hear that from my mom. She comes from a big family that says my father knows alcoholism and runs rampant there, but in our immediate family, I'm the only one that has this problem. She saw it in me. I was not going to go get help. But I now had 5 charges against me. I wanted to go away to school, and I thought, you know what, if I go into rehab, maybe the judge will have some leniency on me. So I did that. I go into rehab at the age of 18 years old with no thoughts of I'm going to stop drinking. I'm just going to make it look good for the judge and get my mom off my back. And I go into rehab at 18, and something happens to me there. I start listening to people because I'm there with them, and I can't help it. And I'm watching like 50-year-old guys break down in front of my face crying that they haven't seen their kids in 20 years, that their mom has passed on without seeing them get better. I'm hearing the remorse, the guilt, and they've given away college scholarships and careers. And right in front of me, I'm thinking, man, and I drink like them. I know I drink like them. And I thought, you know what, I don't want to end up like this. I have a wonderful opportunity. I get to go away to school, have a good career, play tennis, make my mom and dad proud. I'm not going to drink anymore. And I didn't drink for 29 days. I swore I was going to go away to college and be the guy who, you know, doesn't drink and finds the people that don't drink and go to, you know, start some non-drinking thing up. And I already had it. It's called AA. But I swore I was going to do this, you know. And my parents dropped me off on the 29th day, or the 30th day. They dropped me off of me not drinking at school, and they turn around and leave. And some of the guys on the tennis team came up to me that night, and they said, "Scott, we're going to go out some beers. You want some?" And I said, "Yeah, give me a 6-pack of Bud Pounders." Just like that. It reminds me of when Roland Hazard in our histories with Carl Jung, and he's with him for a year, and he really is, he wants to stop drinking. And he stays sober for a year under his care, and he leaves, goes to Paris, and the next day someone asks him if he wants a glass of wine, and he says, "Yeah." And he's off to the races, and he goes back begging the doctor, "Why? Well, I thought you fixed me. I didn't think I was going to drink." And what happened to me was when they came back with that beer, it hit my lips and it got into my bloodstream, and I got that feeling in my head that I love, and my eyes watered up. I remember thinking, what was I doing not drinking for 29 days? This is the best feeling in the world. And what happened was the guys that actually got me the beer, the older guys on the team, they were out. And I'm, it's 4 a.m. and I'm still, I needed more, I got more. And now I know that I don't want to be doing this, and it's on. And I called my aunt, and I started to talk to her about alcoholism and the things I learned in rehab. And around 5 a.m., she said, "Scott, I have to go to work now." And I thought, all right, Terry. And she said, "You're going to be all right. You know, call me in the morning. And we'll, you know, later on, we wake up, and we'll talk and get some help." And I hung the phone up. I passed out. I came to in the morning, and I was embarrassed. I made the phone call. And the party was on. And I drank myself right out of school. And I never played one match of tennis. I was there for just under 2 years. The last semester, I could not even go to school. I'm 19 and a half years old. Alcohol, for me, this is where it became cruel, is that it stopped working. The magic wore off. I was on top of the world at 18. I didn't have a care in the world. I was always wanted to be, a popular kid. I had friends, and it was a big party. And at 19 and a half years old, I can't come out of my dorm room. Drinking's not working anymore. I'm starting to look in other directions for some relief. I made a few cries out for help. I have wonderful parents, like I told you, and they told me, "Scott, we'll get you help right away. We'll fly you home. We'll get, you know, whatever you, if it's too big, you know. And I realized what happened for me was finally, I couldn't do it. I was wasting money. Alcohol wasn't working. I was not getting along with anybody at that school. I was alone now, confused, lost, more than I had been before I picked up alcohol. And I called out for help. I said, God, I got to get home. Now, at the same time that this is happening, juxtaposed to that is the dean's got me in the office saying, we know you're doing illegal stuff here, and we're watching you. We want you to leave, or we're going to kick you out. So that made it a little easier. So my dad, you know, they fly me home. And I'm thinking, if I go home and I get out of the college campus, if I get away from that environment, I'll be all right. And I enrolled in Bucks County Community College. And I start going with my brother. He's a year younger. He was a year younger than me, graduated, and I'm going with him. And after a couple of days, I know who drinks. I know the guys that drink in his class like me, and I start hanging out with them. And before you know it, I would have been the number one. I tried out on a team, and I would have been the number one player. They have a great team. They go to nationals every year. Within 2 weeks of me doing this, we're stopping off the liquor stores, we're stopping off the softball field. I feel out of there miserably. Get all incompletes. Now, I could tell you a lot of colorful stories, you know, as my life went on. But I'll sum it up like this. The next 10 years of my life was meaningless and purposeless. I lived to drink. I worked so I could have money to drink. I used people and took advantage of them so I could drink. And I'll tell you some of what it was like for me and my family was that I would get jobs and I would lose jobs. I get fired because of my drinking. I would end up going home in my mid-20s with my mom and dad. And now I have a sister that's 10 years younger than me who I love. When she was born, I just wanted a sister. And when she was born, I fell in love with her. And I remember coming home from school the first time and wanted to walk into the bus stop. And I wanted to be that big brother, you know. And now I'm in this house as she's grown up. And I'm not the example that I should be. I'm abusive in my family's home. I'm abusive to my sister. And my mom and dad, I'm living with them for months on end, and they're looking at me with, if we're making eye contact, they're looking at me with disgust and what's wrong with our son. And I'm looking at them with shame and guilt and remorse. There'll be months on end where we didn't say a word to each other. And if we did, it was a fight or an argument. They would kick me out, ask me to leave, and I would go live with friends or I would take a hostage, you know, and every once in a while she would escape. I'd have to go capture her. And this is how I lived. I basically lived in the dive bars in my neighborhood up Route 13. And I got kicked out of half of them. But I would get jobs like roofing where I would just work. There's nothing wrong with roofing, but I loved it because I worked. I had a buddy of mine owned a business, roofing business. And I would work whenever I wanted, take off Mondays, Fridays, work 4 days, make $600. And then I party for the rest, you know, of the time. And I'm, when it's raining, I'm happy because I love nothing like waking up and going right to the bar at 7 a.m. You know, and look at Kim McCain's store. And wherever I went after that, wherever alcohol took me, I went. I'm an alcoholic. When I woke up in the morning, the only thing that was on my mind was alcohol, nothing else. And I answered that call every time. And I could not get out of those dive bars. And I'm watching my friends pass me by. Guys who I thought drank like me, they're having families, careers, they're able to stop on Saturdays and then get together Sunday for work on Monday, and I can't. The way I drink, it runs into me, it's just everything runs into me, you know, together. It was crazy. And I'm bringing things into my parents' home when I'm living there that I don't care to share about the podium, and I would never tell them. It was horrible. They kicked me out in my late 20s. At one time, I begged them to come back, and I had nowhere to go. I remember, you know, going back to the girl, and she let me in one more time, you know. And I'm staying there, and I don't have a job, and this is just how I'm living, you know. And I remember, I got in a bar fight. The only reason I know is I had a black guy the next morning. You know, and I show up at my parents' house one more time, but I had nowhere to go, and they let me in. And I had no work, and my mom said, Scott, your cousin Billy just got a great job delivering furniture. Call him up, and he needs a helper. So I call him up. I needed money to drink. He said, come on in at 4 a.m. tomorrow. We're going to load our trucks, and I'll give you a job. And I showed up. And you know what? It was really good money. And we, you know, my cousin Billy, we had a party like I did. So it was a great night. We came, it was great. And I worked this job for about 6 months, and I learned the business. And one day he made a mistake. He went to that in the office where we load our trucks, and he left the check on the seat. And I opened it up, and I saw how much he was getting paid, and I knew what he was paying me, and I knew instantly I need to get a truck, and I need to help him like me. And that's what I did. I went to the guy, because I knew how to do this. It was easy. It was learning furniture. And my cousin had a little business, so I went to the guy who gave him all his work. I said, "Look, Joe, why don't you give me work? Let me get my own truck. I can get a helper." And he said, "How about tomorrow? I need a guy." And I said, "Whoa, I'm not ready. You know, how will we ease into this?" And he threw me maps. He threw me a radio. And I got a helper the next day, and I was out till midnight delivering furniture. And within 5-6 months, I had 5 trucks on the road. I had 12 employees. I had a corporation. And I became one of his best workers. And he's the only guy I got my work from. And kept us busy. And not too long after that, he came to me and said, "Scott, you're my worst guy, and any of my worst guy. I'm not getting any more work." It had progressed my alcohol until a level where I could not function. I was coming to work. I had a drink during the job, and it reflected in my work. You know, and he saw it. And he was in, he actually was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't know at the time, but he told me, "You're done." I had all these trucks now that I had to pay for. I had workers I had no work for. At the same time this happens, I get evicted. I'm making great money. And I get kicked out of my apartment. My utilities are turned off, and now I get kicked out. I have nowhere to go. And that night, I remember I went out, and I went to where I do my best thinking. I went to the bar that night, you know. And I'm with a friend, and we're talking. I'm talking about, you know, where I'm at and basically my life. And she's pointing out things to me that I can't see. And I remember thinking to myself, tomorrow I'm going to get some help. And, you know, in those 10 years or so, I always wanted to call that rehab back. But never got bad enough. The next morning, I wake up, and I'm driving in my little car, and the realization of where I am in my life at 29 years old hit me. I had nowhere to live. My parents wouldn't let me back in. I had no job. And I cried out for help. I said, "God, please help me." And that rehab came to mind. And this time I made the phone call. And I said, "Come on in. Let the, you know, do a little evaluation." And I said, "Okay, how about I come in Monday?" Because it was a Friday. And he said, "Now, how about you come in today?" And I said, "All right." And I went in. Thank God I went in there. And I didn't answer the questions all honestly, because I wanted outpatient. I didn't want inpatient. I wanted to be able to salvage this business I had going. And they gave me outpatient, intensive outpatient, going 4 to 9 every night. And I start going. Now I'm shot at and hit. I'm hurting from booze, and I feel safe going to this outpatient. And the only problem was there was a requirement. You had to make AA meetings. And I'm coming up with every excuse not to make them. After about a week or 8 days of this, everybody else on the chalkboard was making meetings. You know, John had 4 over the weekend at the clubhouse. Sue had 3. Scott, 0. The counselor asked me to stay behind. And he said, "Scott, if you want to be a part of this group, you have to go to AA." And I was afraid to not be a part of that group, because I was afraid I was going to drink. And I was hurting. So at the age of 29 years old, I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And man, was I wrong about what you guys were. I thought you guys were a bunch of people older, not having fun, holding on to your seat. If you hang on close enough together and make it through the day, you won't drink, maybe. That didn't sound like any kind of life I wanted. I couldn't imagine life without alcohol. You know, and I walked in, I sat on the back door. There was a guy, Larry, who I'm friends with today. He had 15 years, he was speaking. I listened to him. He sounded relatively happy. I believed him. And he drank like me. And after the meeting, people came up to me and shook my hand. I'll never forget Tall Paul, the first guy that came up and shook my hand and said, "Welcome. We play music in the basement if you want to come down." I said, "No, I don't play music," but I was thanking him for coming over to me. And I remember leaving that meeting that night thinking, "I can't wait to come back tomorrow." Felt like I was home. And I did come back tomorrow. And I came back over and over again in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did salvage that business, by the way, and it started to boom. And instead of going to the bar and preparing my work where I would go to the clubhouse. It was open 24 hours a day, you know, around the clock, meetings around the clock. And I would go prepare my work for the next day. For that business, because the owner saw that what I was doing, and If you name it, in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was doing it. I came to meetings every day, sometimes twice a day. And I hung out there on the weekends. I showed up early, I stayed late. I listened when the speaker talked. I had a group of guy friends that I hung out with, and we'd go out to the diners or branch out to other meetings and talk about the wonderful things we heard in the meetings. You know, I chaired meetings. I took commitments. I called the commitments, greeters. I became the ordinary intergroup rep. I became the intergroup rep. I left the females alone. I did. I knew I wasn't there for that. I knew I wasn't there for that. And I listened to the old time, the long timers. And I would talk to them. Like, I would show up maybe an hour before a meeting, and I'd sit there and ask some questions and talk to them. So if you name it, and in Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was doing it. And what happened was, I became like a hero to my mom and dad. They invited me back in real quick after I was sober. And they couldn't stop touching me and talking about me to their friends. And what happened was, my girlfriend, who about 3-4 months before I got to AA, cut me off finally completely. I could not believe she did it, but she did it. Did not answer my phone calls at all. Did not answer the door at all. And I knew it was over. And I couldn't believe she did it. But now she's calling me, because she heard that I had 3 months sober. And she can't believe it. Is this true? Yeah, it's true. I'm going to AA. I can't even believe it. You know? And dreams started to come true in AA. I always wanted to travel my whole life. I don't know what your dreams are, but I know what mine are. Ever since I was a kid, ever since I remember being in college, planning a trip across Europe, backpacking, being the most excited about that out of anything, and I never could go to bar school. I watched my brother go to Europe, Asia, all over. I watched my mom, whether in his summer with her friends and her teachers, they would save up and they would travel the world. And I was always envious. I could never get off. I was afraid to live. And my brother, at around 5 months over, says, "Scott, why don't we take a trip to Ireland?" Now, materially speaking, I was better off then than I had been my whole life. In just 5 months of not drinking and making meetings. I had plenty of money in the bank. That business was booming. I said, yeah, why not? And not only that, there was an AA meeting list for all over Ireland in the closet. So that was a sign. You know, yeah, go to Ireland. We start planning the trip, and I end up taking the trip. At 6 months sober, I go to Ireland. I get off the plane with my brother, flying to Shannon, and I realize right away this is going to be hard. Second day in, I'm looking over the ring of curry thinking, why can't I drink with my brother? Why can't I have a couple drinks? Third day in, I make a conscious decision, I'm going to drink before this is over, I'm going to drink. Now, what I didn't tell you, that 6 months of me making meetings, constantly me involved with all that stuff, there was times where I would be with my dad watching a football game or something like that. I'd be thinking to myself, man, this would be better when you have a few beers. Or there'd be times where I'd be playing horseshoes with my family at 4 months sober. You know, not at people places, things. I'm with my family, and my cousin's drinking a beer, and I got one eye staring at the beer, and one eye on him. And I didn't realize that I wasn't free from alcohol. I didn't realize that alcohol still had me. I didn't realize that, I thought I was better, getting better because I was physically more sober. Now I'm 6 months sober, I'm more sober than I've ever been, and I'm living on a dream in Ireland, and I end up on the fourth day in a pub restaurant. That's all they have over there, that's where you eat. My brother wants a beer because he can drink, and I want to drink so bad it hurts. And I would have drank if it wasn't for my brother. But the stuff I put him through, and he knew my situation, and I was in AA, and I shouldn't be drinking. I didn't think I could get away with it. And I said, Will, I got to get out of here. One thing I did here in those meetings listening was, at some point of sobriety, the only thing between you and a drink will be God. And I said, I got to get out of here. And we left. And I went into our bed and breakfast, and I went to the bathroom. I closed the door. I put a crack down, a towel down on the crack of the door. And I got on my knees for the first time in my life. And I said, God, I want to drink, but I don't want to drink. Please help me. And I didn't drink. But what's more is I didn't want to drink after that. It had been taken from me. I walked out of the living room, and I knew something happened, because I think I like drinking more than anybody ever did on the face of the earth. And this time, it was gone. I even flew this Glasgow on my own and went to Edinburgh. I took a bus to Edinburgh, Scotland. And I'm walking around because he had already been there, so he went down to spend more time in Dublin. We did a beautiful trip, 10-day trip all over Ireland. He went down to Dublin. I flew to Scotland. I'm walking around the streets of Edinburgh alone in a foreign country. But I noticed there's bars everywhere. I don't want to go in. There's no pool. There's no attraction. There's no, I wish I could. That's way different for me from the moment I touched alcohol to my lips. I flew back to Dublin and met my brother. And on the way home, on the flight home to Philly, I knew something happened. And I was now interested in Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book. And I had it with me. It just wasn't doing much investigation of it. You know? And I open up. And the first chapter, and what it comes to is the agnostics. And the first line I happen to look down and see is either God is everything or He is nothing. He either is or He isn't, what your choice to be. And I knew He was. And I knew that I would be okay for the rest of my life if I depended on God. And that's all I ever really wanted. Alcohol came close, but it wasn't real. This was real. And I knew it with everything in my being. And this other thought came to me, and it wasn't from me, it was this intuitive thought, inspirational thought. It said, when you get off this plane, you better go see that man you heard talking about the 12 steps in that meeting that you went to every day for 6 months. There was a guy in there trying to do step work with him, but I wasn't letting him. And he was trying hard. But there was another guy who I loved when he would share. And I loved the way he looked. And I was glad when he was at the meeting. But when the meeting was over, I stayed away from him. So I was attracted to him, but afraid of him at the same time. And he was saying things like, if you want contented, peaceful sobriety, if you want to be free, if you want to recover, if you want to walk out these doors and do anything, anything you want with your life, not have alcohol hold you back, you got to do these steps. He was talking about true freedom. And I could tell that he had it in his eyes. And something else about him was, after the meeting was over, he'd be around the table with new guys. And it wasn't so much that, it was that I could tell he wanted to be there with them. Like he would rather be nowhere else than there. And that was, man, what was that about? I wanted it, but I didn't think I deserved it. You know, and if you could really, I wasn't doing this stuff. And if you really got to know me, you wouldn't like me. So there's no way I'm doing this stuff with you. But I know I had a sin. So I went to the meeting when I got off the plane that night, or the next night, whatever, and I moved myself closer to him. So eventually I was at his table. And one day, after a couple of weeks, he said, Scott, do you want me to sponsor you or something? I said, John, everybody asked. And we sat down, we got to work, and here's the thing. This is where my life began to change, right here. This is where the journey began for me, with him, one-on-one, with the book. And I didn't bring anything to the table. I was scared to death. I doubted this, but I didn't bring anything. I didn't bring any of my knowledge. I didn't analyze this stuff. I simply sat there and listened to him. And he opened the book up and he talked a little bit about the history to give me a little foundational basis of where this stuff was coming from. And we started talking about the black letters in the book, doctor's opinion. He explained who the doctor was. And this book, these letters started to come off the page and into me and started to have a life in me. And I started to relate and identify with these first 100, 79, whatever it was, 76, whatever it was. My sponsor started to identify with him. And I learned more about alcohol. I learned more about Alcoholics Anonymous and alcoholism than I did right there with an hour and a half looking at 1, 2, and 3 with him than I did going to these meetings every day, listening, talking to the old timers afterwards. I learned more right there. And I saw what it meant to be powerless. And yet it was me. I always knew I liked to drink. I always wanted to have 4 or 5 beers. That's what I wanted. Just stop in and have 4 or 5 and go about my life. I never could. I always knew for some reason I could not get off the bar stool. But what floored me was the fact that when I'm sober, if I get a day or two together because I was hurting, why don't I go back to it? And you know what? I remember being around 27 years old, my late 20s, walking to the bar and crying my eyes out because I didn't want to go. But I had to. And I remember being at the bar when I literally had tears dripping in my lungs and beard. Because it wasn't working anymore, but I didn't know any other way out. And that's what it meant to be powerless for me. If there's something wrong up here, that I keep going back to it even though I don't want to. No matter how great my wish to stop is, I keep going back to alcohol. And he basically walked me down, you know, down this path, this smooth, well-lit path, and he put my hand in God's hand. And I healed. And we did it the way the book says. I got to talk about some of my experiences with these steps. A lot of this stuff I didn't want to do. I did not think it was a good idea, like getting on my knees with another guy, do a first step prayer. It looked like it looked weak to me. It looked like, I remember walking down in the basement, knowing what I was going to do, because I heard about it, and I thought I was going to throw up. But I did it. I did it with him. Scared to death, did it with him. And nothing great happened. He said, get off your knees, go do a first step. I was afraid. I didn't do it right away. Waited 2 weeks. He said, do I have to set a date or something for you? He said, it might help. He said, how about this? How about you say a prayer? How about you ask God to help you? And I remember sitting at my mom's dining room table, and I said something like, God, I'm afraid to do this for them. It's supposed to be good for me. Please help me do it. And my pen didn't stop moving for 2 hours. They called the magic pencil. And I was done. I called him up. I said, John, I'm done. Can we do the fit? And he laughed. And it reminds me of when Bill and Bob go see Bill Dotson in the bed, and he says, look, we got a solution. And he says, I'm a goner. You can't help me. I want some somebody now, nobody. And they chuckle. They chuckle because they know the power of God. They know that they, their alcohol problem has been solved and that God will help him too if he does this work. And that's what my sponsor laughed, because he knew that God would work for me if I went to him. And we met. And again, a bigger knot in my stomach this time when I met him to go into a park to do my fifth step with him. And as I go into this fifth step, I quickly knew that this man wasn't here to judge me. That he was here with God to help me see some truth about me. And what my real problem was and why I was a failure at life. And I could see it. It was right there. And he pointed things out to me that I couldn't see. And he said things like this to me that I'll never forget. They're with me every day. He said, Scott, you know what your problem is? I said, no. He said, you like to feel superior over people. And you're not. It's just one of. He said, ask God to help you just be one of. He said things like, Scott, you're dishonest. And I have been. I knew I was my whole life. I lied, told you stories, made things up. I didn't know what the truth was. He said, Scott, how about you practice the opposite of your character defects and ask God to help you be those things? He said, why would people want to be around you? I said, I don't know if I'm funny. He goes, no, why would they really want to be around you? He said, if you're honest. As we left that park, I think he did for me the best thing he could have done for me. He said, Scott, I'm human being, I'm fallible. God is infallible. The most important thing you have in your life is your relationship with God. I will be your friend. I'm here if you need me, but I won't make decisions for you in your life. It's what Sam Shoemaker told Bill Wilson. When you see the man with the problem, put his hand in the hand of him who has all the answers. Then go home. Don't stick around and play God. And that's what he did. He put my dependence in its proper place right there. And that has been the most important thing in my life, not my sponsor. We're still friends. We hang out. I talk to them. We laugh. We smile. We talk about new guys and different understandings, with deeper understandings we're having these steps and God and all that. But I think I went to my sponsor twice in 7.5 years with things in my life that I needed to talk with him about. And once I went with his advice, and the other time I didn't, because I didn't think that's what God wanted me to do. You know, and that's what I love him for. He told me to go home and take that hour. He said, take the hour, Scott. That's what it says to do. And thank God I did. Because that hour is one of the best, it's probably the best hour I ever had in my life. I went home, and I just sat there and reflected on what we talked about in the park, and I formally did what it says. You know, thank you, guys, I need better for the moment of my heart. Look over the first 5 proposals. Yeah. But then something happened to me. As I sat there, in an instant I knew alcohol was no longer the answer for me, and God was. Up until that point, if you told me I could have a few drinks and get away with it, I would have done it. At that point, I tried to think about that, and it repulsed me. It made me sick. I think today is because God and alcohol can't coexist. And God, I felt the presence of God. I knew He was real, and I knew I was forgiven for everything I brought to the table in that park and told my sponsor and God. I knew it. I had a clean slate. The shame melted away. And I knew Alcoholics Anonymous worked. Personally, in my heart, that's where AA entered. I think that's important. Because that launched me out onto a never-ending giving away of this gift. It's so beautiful, it has to be given away. It's part of it, I believe. So I leave that hour, my parents' home. I fell into a tranquil nap in the last 15 minutes of it. And I woke with everything the promises talk about after the fifth step came true. Every one of them. I can't believe how amazing Bill Wilson pinpoints the feelings. And I went to a meeting that night, and I remember looking at a girl in her eyes, Elena, who came in about a couple months after me, and we become friends. And I remember looking in her eyes, and I noticed something was different. For the first time in my life, I was able to look in another human being's eyes, and I wasn't uncomfortable. I would have stayed here all night, and it was just an unbelievable feeling. When I was around you my whole life, I had to hang my head. If I had to look in your eyes, it was very uncomfortable. And that was gone. And something else happened to me. As I took a guy home that night who I had been helping, I had nothing real to offer him other than a car ride and a meeting, and maybe a sandwich here and there, or coffee. I mean, that's real, but it's not. I had nothing in here from Alcoholics Anonymous. And now I did. And I said to him, hey, Bill, do you have a sponsor? Because I wanted him to feel what I just felt. And he turned to me and said, yeah, you. And I said, I'll take you as far as I can, Bill. And the next day, we had the book open on Bill 1, 2, and 3 of Bill. And I'm on my knees with him doing a third step prayer. And about a week or two later, I'm in a park, and I'm listening to Bill's fifth step. And what an honor it is to listen to another man's fifth step. And as I leave that park, tears come pouring down my cheeks. Because for the first time in my life, I was connected. For the first time in my life, I knew what it meant to be unconditionally in love with another human being. And I would have given anything up for this man, Bill, to experience what I experienced in that fifth step, the peace that has not left me since. I would have spent as much time in that park with him that it took for him to experience what I experienced. To know that God is real, to know that you're forgiven, it's an unbelievable thing. That's what AA gave me. And that's my primary purpose. And I haven't stopped since. Not because I'm some great guy who wants to run out and do all this work, because God has touched me and allowed and given me something real to give away, because I know He's real. And I know what it's like to be locked up in hell and have to drink, and the shame and the guilt and the remorse and the self-loathing. And your parents looking at you saying, what's wrong with you? And you not even know what's wrong with you, what happened to your life. And then to be free like that the moment you do the work. The moment I did the work, I had purpose. I didn't have purpose my whole life. I never fit in. What a gift. Alongside the freedom I get, because I know what it's like to be locked up. Now I'm free, right? I get purpose to go back to a new guy constantly and be able to offer him what he has given me. And it's given me so much more than a couple slogans to shout out at you. You know what I mean? And what happened for me is that the things of the Spirit started to become more important than the things of the world. And that's why the ninth step is so important to me. And I set out to make all those amends. Because $1,000 in my pocket meant more to me going back to you, who I robbed or I stole. And although I had a business that was booming, I drove around the $500 cars so I could go pay all my amends back. And I had some very hard amends, which, thank God for that guy Bill too, because he was coming up on me quick. And I'm praying for the willingness of some of these events. I'm praying for the willingness and praying for the willingness. Like, I had to go to my dad. They had let me back in the house, and I'm living with him now. I had to go to him and say, Dad, I'm the one that stole your power tools. My dad was a furniture maker and a carpenter, and I picked off about 12, 15 of his power tools, big ones, to go pawn. So I could go get mugs of beer at the wall. And I blamed it on the neighbor. And I had to go to him and say, Dad, I'm the one who did that. I hope you can forgive me. I was wrong. Here's the money to replace that. And my father looked at me and said, I want you to some time on this. It's like a mystery is going to solve here. And I remember, you know, the next day, my sponsor said, you have to take a risk, Scott. Because I was living there, and he could have pulled me out. And the next day he came and he said, come here. And he hugged me, told me he loved me, and he forgives me. And he said, but I don't want the money. I said, no, you have to take the money. He said, no, I don't want it. I said, Dad, no, you don't need it, but you don't understand. I have to get this out of my hands into yours. And he took the money. And I'm so glad that he did. My brother had to go. My brother was the hardest one. I made the easy ones right away. Right away. My mom, you know, my aunts, my ex-girlfriends, you know. But my brother was a very hard mess for me. So I had to pray. And Billy's come up on me. And I had to finally make a phone call. I said, Will, I got to come and talk to you. And he said, all right. And I went and met him in his apartment in Center City. And I'm sitting there. I started crying before I could even talk. And I think he thought I was going to die of a terminal illness or something. He came over to me and he said, all right, you know, what's wrong? And I'm like, I got to talk to you. And I settled down. And I began to say how I was wrong. I wasn't the big brother I should have been. I treated him horribly. I put my hands on you. I talked down to you. I abused you. I don't know how you don't hate me, Will. I admire you for that. We got into a long, nice long conversation. At the end, he hugged me and told me, he said, Scott, I don't think I could ever be as honest as you were right here. I forgive you. I know what that stuff's about when we're younger. My brother's a very well-adjusted human being, and I look up to him. And I left that apartment, and my relationship with my brother began that day, even though I hadn't been drinking for probably 9 months or so, and I hadn't been hurting him. My relationship with him began that day, and today I have a brother relationship, a big brother, little brother relationship with him, and we grow in that every day. Not too long after that, my brother called me up and said, Scott, will you take me through those 12 steps? He's not an alcoholic. But he saw what he did with his big brother. And I sat down with him, and every Sunday he would give me a history lesson, and I would take him through the book. And by the way, he probably knows more about the history of AA than most people do in AA, you know what I mean? And he loves it, you know, because he saw what happened to his big brother. I took him through these steps, and where I made my amends, then the where I started to make that amends in his living room, I listened to his fifth step. And he didn't have a lot of names, but there was a few, you know, that were blocking them all, that he was resentful. And I was able to show him, through AA's experience and mine, where maybe he was not looking at it right, or where he was getting his own way, and he looked at it and he realized that it really freed him. And he had one name that came up to his eight step list. And I wasn't going to tell him to go to Harry and find her because he wasn't going to drink and die if he didn't. So he sat there. I'm not lying to you, about a few months go by, and I get a text message that says, Randy decided the Austin Airport made him incredible. I thought, who's this? Because he had just gotten a new phone. I thought, is this my sponsor? He's coming to my, wait a minute, this is my brother. I get a hold of him. He says, you're not going to believe this. He says, my flight gets delayed coming home with his wife. He was visiting my sister. She's out there. He goes, well, I'm walking to the airport. I make eye contact with Sarah. It's his ex-girlfriend from 12 years ago from North Jersey that he hasn't seen in 12 years. In the Austin airport. And he's like, I knew what I had to do. But I had my wife with me. She had her brother with her. And they go to the bathroom at the same time. And he says, there's an innocent bystander there, but he realized that he had the iPod on. He's like, so he made his amends. He said, I never had an experience like that in my life. My brother moved to New Zealand, I 8, 10, 11, 12, and showed him what to do for the rest of his life. And I'm going to be an uncle in next month or so. I'm going to go out there and visit him in New Zealand with my mom and sister next month and continue to build that relationship. What an unbelievable program here. My grandmom, I got to talk about her because I was never a grandson. And I started to show up in her life and take her places and spend time with her and play cards with her. And she liked to go to AC. I'd take her down to AC and I'd get her out with her walker and I'd have patience. And she would spend hours down there and she loved it. And one day on the way home, I said, Grandmom, if you hit big, what would you do? I said, well, you go to Vegas? That's what I'm thinking. You know? She's like, I would go to Vegas. Are you kidding me? I know exactly what I would do. I would hire a driver to take me up to where I was born up in New Hampshire and driving all around the sea any family that's left, see where I grew up, my friends, and all that, you know. She's 86 years old. I started really saving my money, and through those amends, things happened. And I started applying principles to my finances, and I'm able to save and invest wisely. I called up and said, Grandma, I can do that trip that you were talking about. She said, get out of here. I said, no, I'm serious. I can do it. She said, that'd be too much money in my own room. I'm too old. And what fun are you going to have? I said, Grandma, listen to me. I can do it. I want to do it. Will you let me? She finally gave in. And I made that trip with her. I picked her up, put her in, her walker in, and we ventured to Connecticut, Massachusetts, New Hampshire. I got a chance to go out with some of her family members. Her brother was 91. Her sister was 84, and we all went out to dinner. You know, I got to sit there in her best friend's house with her as they told stories for hours. They were crying. I started crying. Because my grandma never thought that she was going to stay there and see each other again. And she didn't think this trip was going to ever come true. She's 86. This is her last wish on earth. And I got to know my grandma better. You know, I even got a chance that I even jumped over to Vermont and went to St. Johnsbury where Dr. Bob was born. I walk in there, going to a meeting, they asked me to speak. I got a chance to speak in Dr. Bob's home. I come back over, we end up coming home, on the way home, we stop at a nudist colony. We didn't go in. We were like on the border of it taking pictures. We had so much fun. I think I told her I liked this trip a little too much because she asked me to take her to Wisconsin the following year. But I got to know my grandma better. I got to be, AA has allowed me to be be a part of her last wish on earth. And that's the best trip I've ever taken. And I've been on some pretty amazing trips. Those dreams of me traveling and being children are still coming true today. Well, my grandmother passed away not too long after that. And she comes from a big family. Everyone came up to me and talked about how she would not stop talking about that trip. And they asked me to be the one to talk at her viewing. You know, and it was an amazing thing. I've been all through Europe. Everywhere in Europe. I've been all through Asia. I've been in Thailand, up in Chiang Mai, up with the hill people who have necks like this. You know, they put the rings in, and they got wrists like this long, and they hang out with them guys. And some of my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, I organized a trip to go over there. We went to the convention in Pattaya, and we're in Bangkok. And I was in Laos, Burma. I was in Iceland with my mom and sister. I took a trip to England. I got a chance. I was asked to speak in England. Unbelievable. And that's not the way to go, Scott. That's the way to go, God, the way to go, Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody asked me to go speak. Whereas 7.5 years before, you know, 8 years ago, I was homeless. I was broken. I had nothing to offer anybody. And I got to make that trip in England. And I met the most amazing people over there. And they even invited me back after I spoke. I went to Spain with them, on the coast of Spain, with a bunch of friends. Tommy's here. He went. We were talking about it on the way out. I was phone he had. A bunch of guys had never been out of Philly before. And now we're in Spain, living life. Unbelievable. And I end up in Iceland with my mom and sister. And I'm on the top of a glacier on a snowmobile above the clouds in Iceland. And I'm screaming, this is the best thing I ever did in my life, except for talking to Clancy the day before for a couple hours, just me and a few guys. I got a chance to talk to Clancy for a few hours in the backyard of a cookout in England with about four other people. Talk about Chuck Chamberlain. Talk about Bill Wilson, who he knew. Talk about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. I treasure that moment. Because these guys, like Clancy or Bob D, or other heroes of mine, as I go through this process, I have, like Steve and Tom, guys you know, and this is who I look up to and I want to be like, they're not going to be around forever. And Clancy and Bob being these guys are like our last link, and saying, they're our last, you know, link to our founders. And I want to be a responsible member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know about anybody else. I want to be a responsible member of AA. Because AA has given me the greatest gift on earth. It has released me of that merciless obsession where I was a slave to alcohol. It set me free. And I want to honor that every day. I'm a big, big guy in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I study it constantly. I love them guys. I know why I'm here today. I'm here because a bunch of guys and girls got together. And then the females too, like Miss Marty Mann, you know, who I look up to. You know, Ann and Lois. Carl Young, even the non-alcoholics who all helped out. Unbelievable stuff. I'm sitting here right now. free from alcohol. It's unbelievable. And when I sit down with a new guy, I have so much more to offer. That's why I suck this stuff up from these guys, because I have more to offer a new guy. But more than any of that stuff that I've been able to do, travel the world, see the world. And I'm not done traveling yet. I want to see every country in the world. More than any of that stuff, I would prefer to sit in a park with a new guy. I would prefer sitting in a park with a new guy, looking him in his eyes, letting him know that it's going to be all right, that he can be free from this, to help put his hand in God's hand, to watch him recover, to watch his family know that my son, you know, has changed, and maybe he'll never drink again, maybe he'll be a part of the family again, maybe he won't rob me anymore. To watch that new guy, when he brought in another new guy, and watch this chain happen that I have a sponsor, he has a sponsor, I have sponsees, they have sponsees, that I'm a part of something bigger than me. What an unbelievable thing. And for me, the joy of living is not about all those wonderful things that I've been able to see. For me, it's like when I'm living life and something looks bad that's happening in my life, I know I'm going to be okay. And I can't tell you how many times I thought, sober, oh my gosh, how could this happen? It looks horrible. But I've gone to my knees and I've asked God to give me the courage to learn the lesson here, to help me get through it. How can I be of service to Him and other people? And I've come through that experience and something else has come up. A door has opened that it wouldn't have if I didn't go through that hardship or that trial, that tribulation. That's the joy of living for me. And the seventh step for me is not about, you know what the seventh step for me is about? It's about empowerment. It's about all the gifts and abilities and skills that God gave me now get to come out in the world for good. And I get to find out what I'm here for. You know, and that's been an unbelievable thing. An unbelievable thing. It's about God trusting me. And how do I know? Because it keeps putting people in my path to help. And that's unbelievable. If you're new, welcome. If you haven't had the experience where you love Alcoholics Anonymous and you're sitting in this room, I beg you to come up to somebody who has, and they can show you how they did it. Because when I look at my sponsor, we share the same exact solution. His life looks so different than mine. He does. Our lives are different. But we share the same solution. And when we look at each other's eyes, we got the same thing going. Freedom. Peace. And that's what's been given to me. That no matter what I've been through in these last 8 years, tough times, good times, I've had a peace that has not left me. And that's available to all of us. And that's your birthright. So I'm not afraid to live today. Not afraid to live. I was scared to death my whole life. Thank you for letting me share it.